All right, it's time for another Space Junk podcast. We're recording. Dustin's here. And this time, I'm very excited because we have a guest. Beth Johnson from SETI is here. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Tony. Hi, Dustin.
Beth, welcome. I'm so excited. I've been looking forward to this one for so long. And then last week, you know, Tony pretends to be sick, so we had to push it a week.
I do that a lot, yeah.
Yeah, but it's so exciting.
I feel you. I was sick about a week before you, Tony, so yeah. I know how that went.
I had the COVID, as my mother-in-law says it. She calls it the COVID. I don't know why, but that's what she says.
The COVID. It just won't go away. Everyone I know over the last month has had it, and it just won't go away. I don't think it's ever going away. It's terrible.
Yeah, I still have
it. No, I was a unicorn up until that I got it this month, and then it was...
You hadn't had it yet? This was the first
time? I had not had it yet.
I hadn't either.
Yeah. My husband had it once. He got it again. My kid missed out, but I got it, and it wasn't too bad. Thank goodness for vaccines and not getting sick for too long. But yeah,
wow,
yeah.
You two did good. I was the other end. I had it before it had a name, and the nurses are trying to tell me, they're like, it's not, you don't have the flu, but we're not sure.
Oh God.
Yeah,
it was bad, but we've had it several times. Some of my friends are. They're really pushing the boundaries. They've had it 4 and 5 times, and it's not. I just feel like it won't go away, you know. But depending on where you live in the country, some places it's harder to stay away from than others.
Yeah. Amen, brother. That's definitely true down here. So yeah, it's one of those things where I get lucky too. I had all my vaccinations, and I've been boosting every time a booster came up, and so I was feeling pretty good about it. And then, but of course, Charlotte, my wife, she works at the public school system, and she brought it home, and she got it much worse than I did. And she also had the same vaccines I did. So it was interesting, that she got it worse than me. Cause that almost never happens. So anyway,
I was kind of surprised. I didn't get it worse than I had. So I'm actually very pleased that it ran its course easily. I was very worried at first.
Me
That's
too.
The right kind of surprise to have with this stuff, because it's nasty stuff and it can get bad in a hurry. So good. Beth, I am so excited to talk about what you do. I think you have one of the coolest jobs in the world. Certainly a job that I love to follow. I love everything about SETI and what you guys do. And so you get to talk about one of the coolest missions humanity has ever had. First off, can you just describe for anyone that doesn't know what SETI Institute is and what it does?
So SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which was the base of the foundation of the Institute back in 1983, I think, 1984. It was founded in part by Jill Tarter, who is the primary influence for the character of Ellie Arroway in Carl Sagan's Contact. It was setting out with the goal of looking for signals from another civilization from space. So that was the basis of it. That's the foundation, the heart of it. Unfortunately, in the mid 90s, NASA decided that SETI was not something they needed to fund anymore, and all of the public government funding dried up. So the mission of the Institute expanded, and now it has a search for the origins of life in the universe, as well as life off of planet Earth in all of its different potential varieties. So not just looking for a signal from space, but looking for astrobiology, looking at terrestrial analogs to places on Mars to see what the possibilities are. There's been a lot of groundbreaking research that's come out about things called extremophiles, which are creatures, biology that exist and live and thrive in the wildest of environments, low salt, high salt, high heat, a lot of cold, you know, there's just all kinds, and we just keep finding life everywhere. So we're, you know, we've expanded out from just sitting and waiting for a signal to reach us and actually doing some more proactive searching. But SETI is still a fundamental part of it. We have laser SETI programs, which is looking for optical signals. You know, we've recently started a program called Cosmic, which is piggybacking off of the all of the data that the VLA in New Mexico is getting. We are basically piggybacking off of their data feed and getting all of that data for ourselves as well. So sort of simultaneously collecting it to analyze it later. And we just had a press release this week about using AI to search back through some of the Breakthrough Listen results and try and find interesting signals that maybe we didn't notice in the data ourselves, but the AI can be trained to look for those kinds of things. So,
oh yeah, you absolutely have to. I mean, you're in a sea of data all the time with your mission, especially now that it's expanded. But I think those peripheral goals are probably where you start to find the first elements or the first data that prove your mission and the purpose of it. It's probably going to be a little more nuanced than just a head on. Somebody sends us a, "Hey, how you doing?" message.
I think so. I think distances are being what they are. I don't know that a targeted signal is the way to go. Like, I think that even, you know, I personally don't think someone's going to just like send a signal at us, but I think that a lot of the studying we're doing about things like exoplanet atmospheres and searching for biosignatures, technosignatures using atmospheric data, I think is a really great way for our research to sort of turn. And, you know, there's been research that says that, yeah, looking back at Earth from so many light years away, we could see signs of the biology on our planet from that distance. So the possibilities are getting better and better, and we're getting more capabilities as we, you know, frankly, the technology improves.
Yeah, I believe it's going to happen. I believe it's going to happen soon too. You know, Tony disagrees with me. So does Fraser Kane, who I know you are friends with. They both disagree. They think that the likelihood of there being, and I can let Tony speak to this himself, so I don't make him out to sound, you know, terrible like we generally do in most podcasts. But I just think that the universe is just too big. I just think it's too big. There's too much out there. There's too much opportunity for there not to be something to find.
Well, I agree.
You yourself, Beth, said that you don't expect to see a targeted signal. Did I hear that
no.
right? Why do you say that?
Again, I think the distances are huge. You know, the nearest star is 4+ light years away. And so, you know, even going back and forth between that, if there's a planet there, the degradation of a signal is pretty substantial. The amount of energy that you have to use is pretty substantial. And, you know, it all comes down, I mean, the foundation of a lot of what we do in SETI is the Drake equation. You know, how fast can a civilization develop technology that would be something that they could transmit, that they could use? And then how long do they survive that technology? I mean, if we are that one data point that we have, we don't necessarily set a very good example for surviving our technology.
And I don't think people appreciate that enough. Not only that, but there's also when people talk about looking for other Earths and other habitable planets, they don't realize that to human beings or to a species that can make an intelligent civilization, we've only been able to do this for the last 500 million years. For the last 4 billion years on this very planet, it was not habitable to human beings. So we have to look at not just the numbers, which is what the Drake equation does, which is what everybody does when they look up at the sky and they go, well, surely there must be more of these. Well, not necessarily, because there's so many conditions here on Earth that we're not going to be able to replicate anywhere else. I would even go so far as to say, we're not going to find another planet that we can inhabit anytime. Well, maybe never, because of what I just said. The Earth itself, as an example, not only are we not setting a good example, like you just said, for survivability, but the planet itself has had to evolve for 4 billion years before we could even get here. And once we got here, it took off. But how likely, how common is that? And that's obviously we don't know the answer to that, but I think it's extremely rare.
And I think it has to be, you know, stipulated that what we're really skeptical, but at least what I'm really skeptical of, is a technologically advanced civilization, life that has gone the same route that we have. I do think that finding microbiological life, larger yeah. life forms that aren't necessarily technologically advanced. I think that's a strong possibility. I think looking at Earth and the places we have found where life exists, you know, creating colonies of algae on snow, a lot of the creatures who live in these like high salinic, high acidity areas, sulfur ponds, these kinds of things, I think we should be able to find those elsewhere. How easily, how quickly that's going to happen is a whole different story, because a lot of what we do have a lot of planetary protection policies in place that say we can't necessarily go look at places we think that life exists because we don't want to impact that life. So it's trying to figure out how can we find it by observing it in such a way that we don't actually influence it? Sort of prime directive, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll also be interesting to try to determine, did it come from here in the first place? Did it end up coming from here and ending up other places, Mars or, you know, Europa, which I really think Europa is super exciting. Is that something that's talked about a lot at SETI?
Absolutely. Europa and Enceladus both. Icy moons are sort of, you know, that's a stock in trade, definitely. Cynthia Phillips, who was one of my mentors at SETI when I was an intern, I wasn't working directly with her, but she was part of the program. She is now at JPL, and she is one of the PIs on the Europa Clipper mission. So, those are Europa. If you look for an image of Europa, you will find that there is a SETI Institute credit on like one of the major images that goes around. That's because that was a lot of work that we did over there back during. Oh man, a long time ago. And that image got processed at the Institute. I don't even want to talk about how many years ago that was. I haven't been there. I've been there about a decade, but
you've been with SETI a decade.
Yeah, this year. Well, so really quickly, I kind of got started. I went to a SETICon in 2010. We've only had two of these. So there was 2010 and 2012. I kind of started talking to people in 2010. I was working on my undergrad at the time. And in 2012, they had the second one. And of course I went back, and now I've sort of like put myself in front of people and new people and asked to volunteer to help some of their social media stuff, because that was kind of what I was getting into, was doing NASA tweet ups and talking about science, and wanted to help them. Hooked them up with, this will date all of us, Google Plus and Hangouts and the Weekly Space Hangout in particular. Yeah. And had Mark Showalter talk to Fraser Cain about some new moons of Saturn. And so that was kind of how I got my start. So that was 2012. And then in 2013, I actually got my internship, which in the most ironic of ways, because I had them hooked up with Google Plus and Google Hangouts, at the end of our internship, we all had to give our presentation, right? And they inform us, and because now that we do all these things live, you guys will get to do this online. And I went, oh, that's the definition of hoist by my own petard. I did this to myself. So, yeah, and it's kind of amazing to look back and go, wow, 10 years ago, I was not comfortable talking on camera. I was not comfortable, you know, being in front of people. And now I do it for a living.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's all the time. Right. Yeah. I follow it. I follow the stuff you guys do pretty closely. And we met like, what, five years ago, something out in the middle of the desert.
We met at the Astronomy All-Stars, and that was 2018. So, yeah, almost 5 years.
God, it's time.
Was it 2018, 2019? Maybe.
Like I can't follow how long things were ago anymore. It's all just a blur. But
I have to do it by mile markers. So like I have to like think about like what was going on at the time. Yeah. So I know Astronomy All-Stars was a turning point for me. So I'm like, that would have been while I was still in grad school, but before I left, which was the end of 2019. So it was June of 2019. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I didn't realize you were still in grad school when we were doing that All-Stars event.
Yeah, I had gone back for geology, and then I left the program at the end of that year because I realized the whole reason I had gone was to learn about geology so I could talk about planetary science better. But I was already working for SETI Institute, and I realized I have the dream job. What am I doing?
Right, exactly. Yeah, what are you going to do? Go get that so you can go back to where you are.
I'm doing what I wanted to do, what I set out to do in back in 2009. That was my goal, and here I am. I did the thing. I literally made my job for me, and now I've been doing it. So it seemed kind of silly to get into all of the writing a thesis and doing all of that when I didn't need to.
Right, right. No, that makes sense. You know, I'm curious. I have so many questions for you, by the way. But I'm curious because Tony and I, you know, we get a lot of people that really, really love space. People like us that, you know, once it gets in your blood, I say it all the time, but it's really hard to get out. You can't. It's just once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And so it just creates so many questions that create new questions and possibilities in your mind that it just takes you down this rabbit hole that is the best, you know, the best possible exploration you can do as a human, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But we also get a lot of really wild comments and questions and even threats and things along that line. I would imagine SETI is like the center for that kind of attraction where people think that, you know, like things are being hidden and that aliens are being hidden. I mean, clearly if anyone knows, it's SETI. And so do you get a lot of that stuff through social media?
I do. I'm not gonna downplay it. I don't get as much as I think people think. And I think I get a lot less than I maybe used to. There are some fabulous features on the internet that make my life a little bit easier. There's new things called mute and block and report. I do a lot of that. Because I mean, there are some people out there who genuinely have questions and want to have a discourse around SETI, around, the search for aliens, which I don't like to talk about it in the terms of aliens, but okay. But there are also people who are not coming from a position of faith. They're not arguing in a way that says that they want to have a conversation. They want to prove their point. And I don't feel the need to expend my time on that when my goal is to get the information out there and show people what we're doing. So yeah, I do get some of it. I don't get it via email, thank goodness, but I know we do get phone calls at the front counter. I know we do get emails to general addresses. I'm sure Seth Shostak's email is probably just a bucket full of it. It's oddly enough not as bad as I really expected, but there is some of it, and there, especially around things like UAPs, UFOs, it does come down to you guys, you know the secrets, you should tell us, you know, the government's hiding in. It's like you won't tell us because it'll dry up your funding. First off, what funding? I'm not spending that decades ago. Yeah, I'm like, I'm not spending every week begging for money for my health here, people. Well, actually, technically, I am. But it's not for fun. And, and second, there's no way to keep a secret. Like, I mean, have you seen our government? Have you seen, like, the number of things? Space is free. Space is open to the public. Anybody can pull a telescope out, point it up at the sky, look for things, record things, photograph things. There's nothing that's secret. Seth Shostak always tells a story about how he got a call from a reporter saying, "Hey, what do you know about this signal that's been detected?" And he went, "What signal?" You know, because like he hadn't heard about it yet, but it had already hit the media. So these things, right, they can't stay hidden, and they're not. I don't think they're ever going to. I think it's, you know, it's very public and very out there for people to see and get your hands on. So.
So you're sticking to your guns. You're still just going to cover it up, huh?
Dang it, Dustin. Really,
you know, I know it's bad because when you get those messages, I understand exactly what you're saying. Where some people they really want to understand, and other people they just want to attack you. And there's nowhere to go. Tony and I have talked about this many times. No matter how hard you try, because you can come from a place of wanting to genuinely help somebody understand, it does not matter. It just makes it worse. Where then come the threats, then come, you know, all the hate and everything else. And then it gets very public and there's just nothing you can do. But for the people that do want to understand, and I just did a talk at a high school, and there was a girl in the crowd there that asked, and she stood up, and I think it takes a lot of courage. She stood up and she said, you know, my family has explained to me that the earth is flat. They've shown me all the proof. In school here, we learn something differently, but there's a lot more proof. I see the proof online. I see all this stuff. What do you have to say about that? And I think your point there is like, hey, space is available. You know, all of this information is available. You can get a telescope and look through it yourself. You can look at, you know, other planets. You can see all this stuff for yourself. And you know, even the moon, and make these determinations based on your own experience. You don't have to just trust me or anyone else. But it's really kind of sad. And I figured you were dealing with this on a minute to minute basis, being, you know, the center for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I figure people were probably hitting you with that like every 10 or 12 seconds.
It might be. Like I said, I use the tools available to me to not have to
well, it's good if not
burn my energy through on it. So, you know, like, we used to be able to message us on Facebook Messenger, and after about a couple of years, I just said, this is a waste of my energy to try and deal with. And we turned it off because there's a whole bunch of avenues you can use to reach the Institute. Social media doesn't necessarily need to be that easy for you to get through. So, you know, send emails to actual people. I am a social media person. I am a science communicator. I am a scientist. But I don't have the capacity to answer all of that all the time. So you know, you do have to protect yourself, and you do have to protect the Institute. That is a part of my job, is to be aware of what the public facing image is, and not engage in something that could end up being a firestorm on the internet.
No, absolutely.
I mean, that's the last thing. That is like the nightmare of my job, is having that social media meltdown.
Yeah, and it happens, and it happens fast. Mm-hmm. But it's good, and there could be a layer of protection built in just by people that aren't at least interested at some level in science probably don't know what the SETI Institute is. You know, so you probably, I mean, there could be that layer of protection built in too. But as far as public image goes, how is the public image of SETI right now? I know, like, talking about, as you said, like aliens, right? It's not the way that we should frame this, but that's still the way it's framed, especially in the media as mm-hmm. a whole, is talking about aliens is something that has definitely changed over the years in the scientific community, to where it's not something that you see a lot of scientists want to come out and say. I mean, how is SETI, you know, handling that?
I think we try to control the narrative and frame the conversation in ways that are proactive to what we do. So we do try, we're trying to talk about UAPs more, but we want to look at it from a scientific standpoint. A UAP is the new terminology. It used to be UFOs, unidentified flying objects. I think, because again, kind of Dustin touched on this, there is sort of a lack of cachet for that, you know, that starts mm-hmm. to conjure up certain images. So in the last few years, it's become unidentified aerial phenomenon. I think the term has changed even more in the last few months. And honestly, at this point, I just can't even keep track of it. And it's, you know, trying to look at it from a scientific standpoint. And I will say that a lot of what I would get sent on Facebook Messenger and Instagram would be blurry photos. I don't know. It just amazes me that it is, you know, the 2020s, and I'm still getting blurry photos of things in the sky. And I'm like, what is this, 1950? You know, and
you could have a 60 megapixel camera on your phone, and somebody's going to see SETI, and you have a resolution of like just, you know, a couple of tenths of a inch per pixel, and you're still going to get a picture of Yeti or of Bigfoot that is out of focus.
Yeah.
And same with Loch Ness Monster, Elvis, all of it. You're not going to get anything. I agree with you. What the heck? It's just like... And the same people are probably still being abducted. People who nobody's ever... I was walking out in the desert by myself and I got abducted. Okay, well, same ones. You know, it's like nothing changes. It's, I hear you. Technology gets better, but the sightings and the evidence do not.
No, and I think... And it's not to downplay... I mean, I don't want to downplay it. People do see things. People see things that they don't understand. The problem is that there is this immediate leap to, I don't know what it is, it must be aliens. And that is where I think SETI tries to step in and go...
I say that every day.
Slow it down, and let's look at the evidence and say, like, what are we really looking at? But there's so much data to keep up with that you know, we just can't. And so, yeah, it's...
Well,
I'd like to
drill down on that just a little bit. First by asking, sure, what are your main sources of data right now? It used to be when I visited last, which was, I guess, in 2016 or 17, something like that. You guys, the Allen Telescope Array was the main instrument you're using. You just mentioned earlier in the podcast that you're using data from the VLT or the VLA, sorry, the VLA mm-hmm. in New Mexico.
What's the VLA?
It's the Very Large Array, which is an array of telescopes in Socorro, New Mexico. Oh, radio mm-hmm. telescopes. And so you're using data yeah. from them. And interestingly, I want to really know about this. You're using AI presumably to go through this data. So mm-hmm. what other sources besides the Allen Telescope Array and VLA are you using to collect data?
Well, Green Bank Telescope has been involved with the Breakthrough Listen project, and we're part. So Andrew Simeon, who is head of the Breakthrough Listen project, is also our head of SETI. So,
I did not know that. That's interesting. Yeah, you have that connection.
So he wears enough hats that they overlap a lot. So it's us and Breakthrough Listen and UC Berkeley SETI. Anything that we're all kind of pooling everything as much as possible together that we can. So there's Green Bank, there's the VLA now, which is that program's just starting to get up and running. We've been using CHIME. So there's some work that we've been doing with the CHIME telescope up in Canada. So there's a lot of places. It's basically a question of, can we get the data? Can we get our hands on the data? And then, you know, finding ways to process it. And the processing is the struggle. So yeah, sure. More and more, I think machine learning and AI is going to come into play with how we deal with it, because it's just, we're starting to talk about petabytes now.
Radio data is very different from images in the sense that it's sequential. It's a time mm-hmm. series of data. It's basically one dimensional, right? It's just a signal versus time, whatever that frequency is. And so with the Allen Telescope Array, you guys were looking at millions of channels all at the same time, recording mm-hmm. them, storing them somehow. And the VLA does something, I don't know how many channels, but it's a bunch. And so you're saying you're just now getting plugged into their data archive, or are you getting live data from them?
Live data. So we're basically piggybacking on their observations. So, you know, we're not making requests for observational time. We're going to piggyback on whatever observations other people are doing and co-collect that data in such a manner that we can use it to process for looking for signals.
So this is big data with a capital.
Yeah,
I was going to say, you're going to have to leverage AI. There's just no way to, I mean, you'd have to scale the team so massive to sort mm-hmm. through all of that every day and really get the benefit of all of the data otherwise.
Yeah, and there are definitely already some like first pass machine learning algorithms in place to sort of like pull out what might be interesting quickly. Again, like I said, we just had this press release where they ran it on some of the Breakthrough Listen data and discovered 8 new signals that in the data that hadn't been found on the first wow. passes by everybody else. So, you know, it seems to be a good process. We're getting them in place. We're working on them, but you know, it takes time and people to build these kinds of things. So and obviously, you know, you have to be able to train an algorithm, which is always fun.
Right. Everybody's learning about that now. Well, the task has always been, as I understood it at SETI, automated, because no human being can go through it. I mean, as wonderful as that movie was, nobody's doing the headphone thing in front of the VLA, right? Like in that movie.
Right.
I don't think Jill's ever done that. But maybe she has.
Only jokingly. We have gotten her to do it at like cons, with the wig and the headphones.
Do the headphone thing. Come on. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. No, we have gotten her to do it in public, but
what is that? Hang on. Oh
no, it's
no. Yeah, that's but so it's all it's the best of time. It's been automated with using algorithms, presumably written in house at SETI. Now you're looking at heuristic algorithms. You just said, what are you in? Are the people at SETI developing the AI that's going to be used, or are you calling on AI solutions that are already out there? I'm thinking OpenAI, you know, all that stuff. Are you guys using any of that?
There's so many different programs right now. A lot of it is in-house. I will say that the press release that was done. It's an undergraduate student. I mean, thank goodness for our undergrads and our grad students who dive into this stuff and aren't busy filling out grant paperwork. They, you know, they're the ones who've been learning it from the bottom up. And so they're working on that. We also work with Frontier Development Lab, which focuses on machine learning and AI algorithms in science applications. And so they've always got teams coming through that are working on different projects. So as long as we have projects for them to work on, they work on them. I don't know if they have touched on the SETI side of things yet, but they have done other things like trying to find appropriate landing places on the moon for a space base. You know, whereas sitting down and going through hand by, you know, picture by picture and going, this might be a good spot. They're using AI, you know, machine learning to say, okay, this is a crater that has these characteristics. You can put that in this pile. This this is too far from here. This is, you know, too much on the far side of the moon, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of AI going on these days, a lot of it.
I can see how that would work when you're got images and corresponding things like radar data, 3D data of some kind, where you're doing that. You could say, okay, I want to train you to look at the moon in all of its detail. Here's all the resolution. Here's all the data we've got on it. Go learn the moon. And it does that. I wonder how that would work in a SETI context, because there simply isn't a precedent, right? So we don't, unless you guys at SETI, and you could tell us if you do, have some kind of preconceived notion of what a signal that would be interesting to you would look like, then you could train the AI, right? And say, well, look for this.
So things that we're looking for, they want it to be narrow band. So they want it to have that narrow spectral width, just a few hertz wide. They're not, natural phenomena tend to be much more broadband. So that's one of the key things, is you're looking for a narrow band signal. So that's sort of like real right there. Beam. It's got to be real tight beam. You want non-zero drift, right? So you want to say that it's not local to the radio observatory. So you want to see that it has some acceleration with the receivers. So it needs to be moving, basically. You want to know that it's not here. It's not a terrestrial source. You know, it's not an open microwave door. It's not a squirrel in your dish. You know, there's all kinds of things that have happened that we try to rule out very quickly. So basically the other thing is, one of the other things that it needs to be what we call on-source observations. So it needs to look like it's coming from a specific target. So it can't just be, you know, oh, I was scanning and I thought I saw something. You need to be able to say, okay, this seems to be coming from a specific celestial source potentially. So we can look at it with a telescope. We can look at the target. We can see if it disappears, you know, if we're not looking directly at it, that kind of thing. So those are like three of the major characteristics, particularly used recently on this new work that the machine algorithm was trained to look for. So there were, you know, we do have some ideas of what we think we should find as far as a techno signature goes. So that's what we were looking for.
Nice. Okay. Well, I remember there was, you talking about noise. I have two questions on that. First, a quick story. I remember I read an article about Green Bank kept around, I think it was Green Bank, or maybe it was another one in West Virginia, that they used to keep these old checker cabs at the site, these old checker diesel automobiles, because they ran on the ignition system wasn't electric, and it was they could run these things with no radio interference whatsoever, and they kept them around, I guess, for a long time. Noise is a problem, especially on ground-based observatories like you're operating. And so my next question is then, are you worried at all about these satellite constellations that are being launched, like the Starlink and what Amazon's got planned and all of that stuff?
I think from the SETI perspective, no. Because their bands are determined, they're blocked out. So, you know, we can easily say, oh, that's this. It's probably, you know, it's going to be a Starlink, because they're operating on very specific bands themselves. So that that shouldn't be a problem as far as radio observations go. As far as optical observations go, I mean, Dustin, you know the issues with that probably firsthand at this point.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's the other piece. If you're going to be leveraging AI, it really opens up a lot of doors. And I know SETI has already used some citizen science data in the past to look for different things. But now, I mean, is it blown wide open with things like Unistellar and the other stuff? Is that the intent, is to get as much citizen science data as possible as well, or no?
I think Unistellar is sort of the start of it. And it's not necessarily in a SETI capacity. I mean, that's the hope, that say, like, you know, again, we think there's a signal coming from this object. Can we turn our telescopes to it and see if there's anything interesting? But, you know, again, that's going to be still be pretty optical. So, you know, you might not be able to catch things that are outside of the optical wavelengths, obviously. But, you know, it's been great for things like asteroid mapping. You know, if there's an occultation, you can turn those Unistellar telescopes and catch that. And we can actually create some better maps of asteroids that we're trying to figure out, all of these, you know, near Earth objects. So, and also helping detect exoplanets, because again, if you're doing, the transit method of looking for exoplanets, you know, an optical telescope is great for seeing if that light dims in a regular pattern. And being able to have more telescopes look at it than not, it, you know, right, the more data you get, the better. So, those are a couple of ways that the Unistellar program is definitely helping and providing some of that citizen science side to things. As far as, and I know everybody's going to, I'm sure everybody wants to know, so I will do this, SETI at Home, which a lot of people remember, was your screensaver that ran and it made like all the pretty blocks and waves and was processing SETI data. That was run by UC Berkeley SETI. SETI Institute was not involved in that project. It is currently on hiatus. And because they had so much data that has been processed that they now need to kind of go through and see if there was anything there.
Sure.
And now, of course, now we're getting these new machine learning techniques. So we might be able to go back and look at some of that again in a new and different way.
Well, and so that's kind of where I was going, is I know that people will be interested in participating in whatever way they can. And I should mention, so that you don't have to, that anyone that does want to give to SETI, there are multiple ways to do it. But right on the SETI homepage, there's a red button that says give now, and you can actually set it up. It's pretty cool. I like the way you guys did it. It allows you to give specifically where you want to SETI. Mm-hmm. And it also allows you to set up like a one-time or a monthly for whatever amount. You can put a custom amount in, or it's got little options there, $25 or something. But I think it's really important that anybody that can, and if you're interested in the SETI mission, it's something that you really should do and support this so it can keep going, because it's not getting the same money that it used to from its early days, right? It's changed a lot. And so I think it's really good. It's something we can do. Also the swag. Like, I really like these shirts. I'm actually filling my cart up right now as we're talking. And so, you know, I'm looking at all this stuff, but I think that stuff is awesome. It's such a great mission that anyone that can support, I think it's the way to do it. Go check out the website.
Is that your primary funding source, the public, or do you have other sources?
So our scientists, most of the scientists who aren't working directly on SETI projects are funded through grants from NASA and the NSF, variety of other governmental agencies. As far as SETI goes and the SETI organization, that's funded by donations. That's donations, you know, heavy donors, heavy gifts, and then just everyday gifts, you know, doing all of the outreach, doing all of that stuff, that is all donation. So, and most of the SETI work. So there's starting to be some more governmental grants coming that way. SETI is coming out of the dark, so to speak. It's becoming a lot more acceptable to be a SETI researcher than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah,
was like, oh, you do the thing, huh? Oh,
yeah. There was a stigma. There was a stigma for a while.
There really was, and so it's nice to see it come out of the shadows and actually get some of the more scientific attention that I think it deserves. I mean, I didn't join the SETI Institute because just because it was here. I joined it because it was, I want to be a part of this. I think that, you know, the funding is starting to get a little bit better, but for the most part, we are funded by donations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's really cool. And the right on the homepage, because I'm on your homepage now, you know, there's that question. The very first question on the homepage is, where will you be when you find, or when we find life beyond Earth? And that's a pretty powerful question, because we've all had those moments in our life, those big impactful moments that are shared globally. Generally, they're negative. Most of them have been, but some of them are positive. You know, I know for so many, you know, it's like the moon landing or things like that. But that one right there, I mean, that is the answer to one of the oldest and most important questions that humanity's ever had or experienced, which is, are we alone? Even if it's just bacteria, so that's such a massive discovery, one of the biggest discoveries ever. And I think that it is one of those things that's like, it's a really important question, because it will happen, in my opinion, it's going to happen eventually. It's an inevitability. And when it does, you know, it's going to be one of those things that's like, you're going to remember where you were when you found out that humanity is not the only living things in the universe, or not, you know, Earth is not the only living
thing. I think one of the things that goes along with that is it's like any other scientific discovery. You just need to get that first one under your belt.
Yeah.
And then the rest of them will start to roll in, because, you know, once you find a pulsar, you start looking for pulsars and you find pulsars. Once you, you know, find a fast radio burst, you start being able to find more fast radio bursts, because you know what you're looking for. You know what the signals are. You know what the signs are. So I think if we could just get that first one, whether it be, you know, microbiological, whatever, we'll be able to find more after that, because we'll know how to look for it. We'll know what we're looking for. Right now we're still in that, it could be anything stage. So.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The blank sheet is the hardest, right? And so it's like, once you know a path forward, even it can be developed from there. But, you know, one thing that we've seen that's been extremely positive, I don't know if you've been keeping up with the equipment side of things, but even in the last 5 years since that event out in California we did, you know, the prices of equipment have come down drastically. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the same equipment has gone up drastically. And so the barrier for entry is come way, way down, and people are doing more of it. But because of that, you know, more people are doing it. So they're experimenting more. They're trying new things. They're taking different interests. Like, some people are doing a lot of like satellite tracking. Other people are only interested in this extraterrestrial search and these things. But we're seeing way, way more people contact us looking for systems specifically for these types of purpose, to contribute to science and scientific data, which I think is awesome, because it's only going to progress from here. Because as you said, like, once you have a success, then everybody's going to be interested in pushing that boundary, you know, and trying to figure out what's there. But I think that we're right on the verge, just because the technology is getting so damn good so fast, you know, that we have opportunities now that we didn't have, even, like I said, 5 years ago.
Yeah. I think, like, a lot of these new types of telescopes coming down, which controversies aside, I think are definitely lowering the barrier for people who want to get involved in things like astrophotography and do these things. I mean, I know for me, like, I love astrophotography. I think it's an amazing thing to do. I have no interest in buying thousands upon thousands of dollars of equipment and learning how to use software. Like, for me, that's like, no, like, I just want to look at your pretty pictures. So I go off and I will look at anybody's amazing astrophotography. I love it. It's an overwhelming field. So to see some of these newer telescopes come out that are allowing people to basically just plug and play, essentially, and see some of the things that, you know, I think people should be able to see from cities, even, right. You know, I think that's a huge benefit to everyone. So,
yeah. Well, you talked about narrowband filters or narrowband in general, but narrowband filters for optical wavelengths is something that's completely changed the game. I mean, when you have multiple band passes on a single filter, like the things like the triad filter and these that, you know, astrophotographers are using, it made color cameras cool again. Everybody started buying color cameras again, and then you're getting more astrophotography done because it's simpler. You know, you just put that on there, and then, you know, for a long time, it was impossible. If you lived in a city, what were you going to do? You can't shoot luminance in a city. You know, what are you going to do? But the technology is just making it all possible, and I really think that everybody really has an interest in space and looking up. It's just, it hasn't been accessible for a very long time. And then the other little things, like, you can't say the word you know, alien or extraterrestrial out loud without people being like, oh yeah, you're one of those people, right? But I really think that stuff's going away because it's not only possible, it's probable now that this stuff is, we're turning that corner.
And I think that, you know, again, it comes down to these barriers for entry. You know, I know when I went to buy my first new telescope, because, you know, I'm one of those kids. Yes, I looked at Saturn when I was like 7. My brother got me a telescope at Sears. I don't have it anymore. I did for a long time. But it was hard, you know, even as a kid, like, okay, setting it up and getting everything taken care of and looking at stuff was difficult. And then, so when I went and said, I want to get a telescope and I want the best I can get for my money, but I don't want it to be something that I'm going to not use.
Right.
I got a Dobsonian because that I could just basically, I mean, it's a 10 inch. I was really, truly, I had the budget and was going for it, but I went and just got a 10 inch because it's like, I can take it out. I can put the base down. I can set the telescope up. It's collimated. I know how to do the things. And now I can just show people stuff. And that was important to me. And I don't have a go-to on it. I'm not fancy. Yeah. I'm basically a star hopper. I've impressed my astrophysics teachers with this. They're like, wait, you do your sky watching with star hopping? I'm like, I do. I'm a give me a sky star map girl, you know, just,
yeah,
you and I will Tony manage. Both.
You and Tony both, like, you
guys Dustin, actually know Dustin can't do that. You know that? He can't do that.
I probably can't. I can find my way around okay, but yeah, I mean, yeah. I'll give it to you. My systems are fully automated. Like, you know, they'll go and they do all the heavy lifting, yeah. And then I just get to take all the credit.
In his driveway, using his 20 inch, I now have I had the Ring Nebula dialed in his driveway, and he goes, "Damn, you already got that up there?" And he's like, yeah. "So I don't think Dustin could do it." He's like, "I need my computer. I gotta where's my auto guider? Where's my autofocuser?"
We had a 20 inch Dobsonian at f/3.8 or something like that, sitting literally underneath a street lamp, and he's pointing it up almost at zenith, right past the street lamp, to look at the Ring Nebula. You know, my surprise wasn't just that he found the Ring Nebula so fast. It was that he was brave enough to look through the eyepiece, you know, when he's pointing a 20-inch daub at a street lamp.
Yeah, well, at my age, I've got cataracts, so I ain't going to do that much.
Damn it. Oh. But no, I agree. And I think you made a good choice, too. A 10-inch daub is like a really good size.
That's a good scope.
For people that... Yeah, exactly. For you, it's still portable, so you can bring it out places, mm-hmm. but it's big enough that you can see what you want to see in a dark sky.
I mean, I took it up to Auburn, California, stuck it out on my uncle's porch on a balcony, and showed my dad Neptune. And that was probably one of the like highlights of my life, was like, "Hey dad, come here. I have Neptune in my telescope." And he's like, "I'm sorry. What did you do?" Now my dad is a retired rocket scientist. So, you know, the interest in space goes deep. So he comes out and he looks at me, he's like, "Well, that's pretty cool." And then he went back inside, and that was it. That's all I got. But, you know, for me, that was like, that was pretty much a highlight.
Good for you.
Yeah. I really like that telescope. It's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, how many humans have ever been able to say that? "Hey, come check it out. I've got Neptune in the view." Like not many. It's a small number.
I think the only thing I haven't seen at this point is Pluto, as far as like the major things. I mean, I don't do a lot of asteroid and small body hunting, but you know, as far as the planets go, I've seen them all now, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but we both know that Pluto's still a planet, right?
No, I'm not getting into this argument.
Oh, here we go. Always somebody wants to troll about this. Pluto is just there. Okay, so both of you have said, and I actually agree, that we are more likely to find life elsewhere in the universe in the form of something not intelligent, something that may be a plant, it may be a slime mold, it may be something like that, whatever it happens to be. That'll probably be where life forms. And we have precedent for that here on Earth. That sort of life formed here roughly 3 billion years ago. So the Earth was roughly 1.5 billion years old when life like that started here. So my question is, I know what it would look like in a spectrograph, when you look at atmospheres of other worlds, what to expect to see. There's a certain kind of methane, not just any methane, but it has to be a certain kind of methane that would be produced by animals and plants. And there's other, what they're called, biosignatures. That's what these are called. And they're getting those biosignatures, at least they're starting to now, from places like JWST's NearSpec by looking at the atmosphere, at the spectrum as it goes through the atmosphere. What would a biosignature look like in radio? That isn't of the intelligent variety, right? Because we know TV shows, whatever, but...
That's a really good question, and I honestly don't know the answer to it. So I don't even know how to answer that one.
I don't either. It's an interesting. I don't know that SETI would actually find that sort of life, because you seem tuned, as I understand the way you're searching, you seem tuned more toward these technological narrowband, not drifting signals that are probably produced by a device of some kind. Right. So, so
you would have to though, right? Like, I mean, it makes sense to search that way, because I don't know much about radio telescopes. I know that typically, you know, there's several of them to increase the resolution on target of whatever it is, but, like, or at least a network of them. But even then, radio is still not going to have the resolution of the other tools you're using. Will it?
It can do pretty well. I'm not going to even pretend to be a radio astronomer. I am not in any sense of the word. I don't want to missay things. I mean, honestly, go if you want to know more, and you have access at Noisy Astronomer, Nicole Gugliucci.
Oh, Nicole's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Nicole is a radio astronomer. She can answer those questions much better than I ever will.
Yes.
I'm a planetary scientist by trade. So for me, it's like, I can tell you all about planets and rocks.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I think the telescope to beat right now is ALMA. That's got the highest resolution radio imaging that we can come up with. But another one to look for will be the Square Kilometer Array. And again, you're right. Nicole is a great resource at Noisy Astronomer on Twitter. And she also does, I think, when I met her in Austin, when we did the JWST thing, and I think she still does outreach, doesn't she?
I think she does some. She's been really focused on her teaching, so I'm not sure.
Okay, maybe not. But
I'm not sure what outreach maybe she's still tweets. Doing, but
maybe she's still
she tweets. Does still tweet. I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a good question for her. I'll have to hit her up and say, "What about this?" Because I'm curious. I don't know what it would look like.
Yeah, well, I have no idea. I don't know anything about radio astronomy at all. There's quite a bit to learn there. But
the extent of what I know is the sense of excitement I had when I got to put in the command to move a telescope within the Allen Telescope Array.
Yeah,
that was a moment of everybody was like, okay, so here's the command to move the telescope, and here's how you number each of the individual ones. So that one there is that one, and that one, and that one, and so it was like, okay, on our computer, we're like, all right, let's do the thing. And we wrote it and it moved. And all of us were just sort of cheering, and it was ridiculous. There's video of it out there somewhere. We were all just my internship cohort, we were very excited at being able to move the telescopes. So
are you still expanding that array, or is it I thought I saw plans of it being larger than it is at some point in the future.
It was supposed to be larger. I believe the final number was supposed to be 200 telescopes,
right.
And I think there's still land for 200 telescopes. However, we ran out of funding at 42. Jill said that 42 was the perfect number to stop at. If that's the kind of money that
very
we had, then we were stopping at 42.
It's a good number.
And obviously, by the name, the reason that we have those 42 is because of Paul Allen. So I will say that it was his generosity that allowed that much of the array to be built to begin with. And then I also want to make sure that I give a shout out to Franklin Antonio, who basically gave us the funding to upgrade all of the antenna feeds, so that they got updated in the last few years. And so those two benefactors were ones that really kept SETI research alive through the last few decades. So huge appreciation for that.
Can you explain why you need so many?
Again, the more you have, the better the resolution. So, you know, you want a fuller picture, you want more detail, you want more radio telescopes gathering data. And one of the things about like the VLA is that you can reconfigure them. They're on tracks. So you can actually like move them around and reconfigure the distances, the baseline distances between the farthest one. Look, I used a term. So you can do the same. You can't move the Allen telescopes or scope array telescopes around that easily. But you know, if we had more, then it wouldn't matter. We could just have more.
So just each telescope acts as a resolution element, and the more you have, the more resolution you have.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So think of it like the way that it was kind of explained to me was, if you think about like the a mirror on your telescope, you know, you talk about, you know, I have a 10-inch Dobsonian, and that means that I have 10 inches of glass to deal with, right? If you think about a radio telescope, the farther apart that your telescopes are, the bigger your piece of glass, your dish is, your collecting surface is. So when we talk about like the square kilometer array, we're looking at a square kilometer worth of collecting capacity. And that's massive. So that's why we want to do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's how, that's the best way I can kind of lay good. That out. That's, I mean, that's,
yeah, that makes sense.
The Event Horizon Telescope used the entire Earth as its diameter. So that was another example of that. Before I let you go, I just want to get some sense of how do you observe? I mean, do you guys look at portions of the sky and then move throughout the night, or do you see the whole sky at night? How do you observe?
It's targeted. So there isn't one that does like all sky observations all the time. I think that is a capability that we will now have because we actually are in charge of and run the Allen Telescope Array. We've shared it in some capacity with other organizations for a long time. And in the last couple of years that has ended. So now all of the telescope time can be ours, and we could start doing more all sky surveys, but a lot of it has been very targeted at signals sources that we of interest. So Kepler objects, TESS objects, fast radio bursts, gamma ray bursts, things that, you know, we want to take a look at and see, is there a narrow band possibility coming from any of these? Is there something that we can detect? So for the most part, the Allen Telescope Array has been a fairly targeted search. There's hopes that that will be a more broad search as we go, and that we'll just, but again, you know, that's a lot of data.
Yeah.
So, and it's a lot of storage capacity, and although memory and that kind of thing has come down in cost, it also, the more you need of it, the more money you need to right. have no, in absolutely. The kitty to add, you know, servers and racks, and
it's expensive.
It gets to be a lot. We luckily, due to, like I said, donations from people like Franklin Antonio, that we were able to do a lot of upgrades in the last few years. So you should start seeing some more news coming out of there, I hope.
So I have one last question for you. People, obviously, you know, the people that know SETI love SETI, and I know people are going to want to follow what you have going on, the social stuff, and then even just the images you post. I know you post the images that you find. So how can people participate? How can they follow? How can they, you know, be part of all of this?
So SETI's social media, my baby, you can follow us on Twitter at SETI Institute, Facebook, Instagram. It's all at SETI Institute, LinkedIn, and TikTok, which if you want to see me, I tend to do TikToks, start trying to do some more and more of them. And I know that's a little controversial. Again, I understand, but hey, it's kind of fun. And we're, you know, YouTube, we have SETI Shorts, we have SETI Lives, almost every week. We have SETI Talks once a month. All of these things are free to participate in. So, just sign up for our e-news, on the website, and, that will tell you on a weekly basis what we're up to, what our next programs are. We also stream on Twitch, that might be picking up. So there's plans to do some more stuff. All of those are ways that you can kind of follow us and keep track of what we're up to. I basically recommend the newsletter and the social media of your choice.
And doesn't Seth also have a podcast, or is that not going?
It's the podcast. One of the podcast, the main podcast right now is Big Picture Science. That's run Seth Shostak and Molly Bentley. Every week, take a look at a science topic of interest. And it's pretty wide ranging. And it's basically sort of any impact on life on Earth, which is a lot more than you think. And so that comes out every week. I think there's new episodes once or twice a month, but the encores are always fascinating as well. And then our SETI Lives, hopefully today I'm going to get our first one posted, and we're turning our SETI Lives into a podcast as well. So as soon as I figure out stuff.
Yeah. All right.
I am the one on the microphone. I'm usually not the one doing all of the editing. So this is going to be fun.
I don't edit anymore. I gave it all up. I'm posting this baby as is. So.
we always do.
Yeah, this is raw. That's what we're calling it. Space junk raw. No, that's not. All right, guys. Anything else, Dustin?
No. Thank you so much for joining us. This is fascinating. I've really been looking forward to this, and we'll have to do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Beth Johnson from SETI Institute. Looking for life elsewhere on the universe. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you guys listening and or watching and doing all the things that you do. Share this podcast. Let people know it exists. Let people know that you find this podcast among the best you've ever heard. Life-changing stuff. Let us know and give us a feedback. spacejunkpodcast@deepastronomy.com. I'm Tony Darnell with for Dustin Gibson and Beth Johnson. Thank you all for listening, watching, and as always, keep looking up.